course, Stalin was a very amusing man, had a very light, fey sense of humor. And, of course, it is true that he was probably responsible for the torture and murders of tens of thousands of dissident Russians, intellectuals, monarchists, and so on. However, when you were with the man, I found him quite entertaining. He used to tell stories of his childhood in which he played all the parts, and with children he was just wonderful. All the children I remember, his grandchildren, they used to love him, sit on his knee. He would roll around on the floor with them and sprinkle vodka on them. And I remember at one festival with the children, he got into a marvelous food fight with them, throwing bear fat and bear fur hither and thither in the room. Actually, it really turned into a terrible tragedy. Two of the children had to be hospitalized. He became a little violent in his play, and he seriously injured two young girls. Turned out that they were completely suffocated with bear fat, and he really didn't accept it. He claimed that they were asthmatic, and we never discussed it afterwards.
You wrote that Hitler was actually a woman.
Yes, there's no question in my mind that Hitler was a woman, and those in the inner circle knew this all along. As a matter of fact, not only was he a woman, but an extremely attractive woman, slim, almost boyish, very passionate. Strangely enough, she was from the German aristocracy, originally descended from the Habsburgs, and created the image of Hitler as something that she felt would appeal to the common people. And the image of Hitler was very carefully worked out. Of course, Goebbels had a great deal to do with this. And Hitler was basically a media myth created by Olga and her people. And ultimately, she manipulated the inner circle completely by sex. She slept with Himmler, she slept with Göring, she slept with Speer, she slept with Bormann. Secretly, of course, she was intimately involved with Eichmann, who she found to be a kindred spirit. They would meet secretly in dark, secret places, on top of a train, under a bus, during a bombing attack, in a fighter. Because she was Hitler, she could go anywhere she wanted and do anything she wanted.
But what was it about Eichmann that she found so attractive?
Probably it was his appetite for red meat that may have particularly interested her.
This is surprising to me because I was under the impression that she was a vegetarian and that she mocked and scorned meat eaters.
Well, I believe this is true. However, it was that very oppositeness of Eichmann, his fattiness, not that he was fat, but that he enjoyed fat, that he ate red meat, that his blood was so red. I think that drew her to him. And really, their relationship was one of a love-hate variety, but in many ways, I would suspect that her relationships with the entire Supreme Staff was based on a love-hate relationship.
I have been holy, and I have been evil. I've been rich, I've been very wealthy, and I've been very happy. And I have been to Indianapolis, and I have been to Korea in 1953. I have been to Venezuela, and I've been to Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And I have been to the moon through my imagination watching that wonderful program on television. And so today I want to speak to you about astronauts. Now, I'd rather speak to you about cashew nuts today and the great plantations and... Rather than that, I think today I would like to approach engineering.
Confusion itself is something that God has put here for us all to understand what confusion is. And if we can understand the nature of confusion, then we can understand the nature of God. If we can be confused without being upset about being confused, or be upset about being confused without being upset about being upset that we are confused, then we are seeing God in the way God intends us to see him or her or it, whatever it is or God is. So, even if you are looking through a window at a woman doing what she should not be doing, which God has intended for her to do, and she turns out the light and she stops doing what she shouldn't be doing, which God intends her to do, and you are thinking, because you cannot see her, because the light is off, that she is doing something that she should not be doing, because God has intended for you to think that she is doing something that she is not doing, but she is doing something that she should be doing, because God intends that, and you can only see the window and the curtains, because there is no light inside, and you are thinking that she is doing something wrong because God intends for you to think that, and she is doing something right because God intends for her to be doing something right. And you say to yourself, I will go inside and make the woman stop doing what she should not be doing. Then God is making you do something that you shouldn't do, because the woman is in her house and you are on the street. But if God makes you do something that you shouldn't do, then that is right. Then God is making you do something wrong. And you can say, in your defense, God made me do it. But that does not mean that God does not intend for you to have your hands and your tongue cut off because you did something that you should do, although it should not be done because the woman is doing something that she should do, whatever that was, not something that she shouldn't do, which you wanted her not to do, and came inside the window to tell her not to do.
You taught at Princeton for 2 years and developed a rather close friendship with Einstein. What were your impressions of this genius?
You know, he did most of his work when he was 19 years old. That's really where he made his breakthroughs as far as relativity is concerned. And from then on, although he did live to be quite old, the rest of his life was really a following up of his original breakthroughs. Of course, Al was very haunted by this, and desperately, as he went on in life, wanted to make new inroads into the physical universe and make new discoveries. For example, he became extremely interested in reverse entropy as he got older and became profoundly preoccupied with the idea of going backwards, going in reverse. And he tried to develop a numerical system that was entirely negative, in which no matter how you would put numbers together, you would always get less. He tried to look at reversal in physical terms, to try to evolve formulas that would suggest that ultimately we were actually moving backwards in time, but didn't recognize it, saw it as a forward movement, as development, but actually were regressing.
What of his affair with Marilyn Monroe?
Well, it's interesting that you should ask about that, because that may have been one of the pivotal experiences of his later years. Marilyn was not at all the frightened, neurotic, dumb, blonde bimbo that her film persona appeared to be. She was extremely quiet, very quiet.
I've seen God in high-quality fertilizer, and I've seen God as well in chicken scratch. And God is in those big dry cleaning machines. In fact, God is in the dryer at your laundromat. God is in the clothing, and he's in the biodegradable solvents and detergents. He's not in the others yet because they didn't allow him there. God is in the sewage and in the streams. God is under the roadbed, and God is in your head. God is in all the extension cords and the three-prong plugs, the two-prong plugs, the fuses. He's in the wiring in your house. When that light goes on, know that God is there in the light bulb. And God's especially in the fluorescent bulbs when they're warming up, and you can see the spirit come in and light that gaseous material that illuminates our lives. God's in what you're reading, so watch what you read, or you'll read it into God. God is in your shoes and your socks, tennis shoes especially, because the children wear them. God's a hand warmer on a hunting trip. God's in the campfire, in the pack of matches in your pocket. It's in the lighter fluid, and especially all those little gas lighters everyone's running around with. They're so popular today. God is in the heroin, the barbiturates, phenobarbital, Percodan, the heroin, the opiates.
Basically, Freud was in it for women. This was a way to meet people and to meet women specifically. But you remember Freud's couch. That was 2 years later, after he began his investigations. He realized that he didn't have to wait for the second or third date before he could really get involved with a woman. He could bring the couch into the psychoanalytic situation and simply indicate that such things were acceptable at a very early stage of the psychoanalytic process.
Picasso, what of his relationship with Gertrude Stein?
It's really something that's not very well known. They had an explosive affair. Gertrude's whole persona, literary persona, was based on her being a lesbian. And she became enraged when her affair with Pablo threatened to become public. She was afraid that she would lose her entire audience and would be revealed as a false lesbian, which she felt, as far as her public concerned, they would never forgive her for. And I even have some evidence that she did some of his paintings. You notice how completely his styles changed during this period, when he went from his blue Greek period to his early Cubist period. My suspicion is those are some sketches of hers done while under the influence of laudanum.
You don't think much of Picasso's work? You think he's overrated?
If the public likes you, you have a right to be liked by the public. The public needed artistic heroes at the time. And I would say Picasso was in the right place at the right time with work that was both accessible to the uneducated and analyzable by the professionals. He is the connecting link between modern art and contemporary marketing. And I think that he was very smart because, not unlike Dali, he used humor to soften the blow. But Pablo, it was totally blind in the left eye from birth, which may account for his inability to see depth visually. You'll notice that he works around three-dimensionality. He solves the fact that he can't see depth in some very interesting ways. And I think that his block figures and his early abstract work really are his solutions to seeing the world with only one eye.
You know, one of her most beautiful songs from that time? Niemand kennt die Tragödien der Vorstadt. Nobody knows the tragedies of the suburbs. Beautiful. Well, she was at her best before she became a star as we know her now, because her early songs are full of melancholy and beauty. It's fantastic. She had one song which goes, wenn ich mir was wünschen dürfte, käme ich in Verlegenheit, was ich mir denn wünschen sollte, eine gute oder eine böse Zeit. Wenn ich mir was wünschen sollte, möchte ich etwas traurig sein, denn nur wenn man gar zu glücklich ist, hat man Heimweh nach der Traurigkeit. Goes, if ever I could make a wish, I would be at a loss, but perhaps I would wish for a bit of sadness, because if you're too happy, you'll be homesick for a bit of sadness. Well, she was die fesche Lola, der Liebling der Saison, and she had a fantastic almost accent from Lower Saxony when she first sang. People in Germany make fun of that accent. Instead of saying Saison, she would sing Saison. And she had a funny way to pronounce Männer, Männer, all I want now, and so on. She had a fantastic charm, which is this mixture of refined beauty, elegance, a certain coolness, and yet a certain melancholy at the same time.
Marlena and I met at a party in New York City many, many years ago. It was a costume party, and interestingly enough, I had come as Marlena Dietrich. But of course, I didn't really look like Marlena Dietrich, but I was wearing black underwear, black stockings, garter belt, had a top hat. I was carrying a chair with me. I came the way she dressed in the Blue Angel, which is the way I think a lot of people still think of her. Of course, by then she was getting on in years, and she was in at least her late 50s, if not older. And from that night on, for almost a half a year, we were inseparable. I remember once we were at the Rainbow Room, the old Rainbow Room in Manhattan, and she suddenly decided to that she had to dance and jumped on the tables, and of course by this time she really wasn't very good lifting up her skirt and showing her legs and flirting with the men and the women. You know, she was bisexual. Actually, she was multisexual.
By that you mean what? What?
I mean that she was attracted not only to men and women, but also to inanimate objects. Near the end of our relationship, actually, the thing that finished my relationship with her was a terrible infatuation she had for a Brancusi, a large steel sculpture that was almost 6 feet high, sterling silver. It was mounted on an ebony case in a museum. She wanted to buy it. She wouldn't leave it. Finally, she convinced the curators to let her take it back to the hotel with her. I was extremely embarrassed. She started to actually take the sculpture to bed with her and began to deck it out in a silk Dior robe. She would sprinkle oils and unguents, salves, powders all over the sculpture and began to pay absolutely no attention to me. And eventually she tried to find someone to get her to marry the sculpture, but no one would. To the best of my knowledge, she never did it. And as I understand it, she soon grew tired of it and moved on to something else.
Going back to the earlier part of the relationship, how did you spend time with her? What did you do together?
Well, she loved to watch all her old movies from Hollywood and from Europe before. Occasionally, she would watch them forwards and then backwards.
Why backwards?
Perhaps in her own way, her interest in going backwards perhaps was connected with her desire to move back in time to a time when she was more attractive, younger, more vibrant, more popular. The meals we ate also were eaten in reverse, with the dessert and coffee first, and then the main course, and then ending with the hors d'oeuvres and an aperitif. And, of course, she also played chess in reverse, starting with the no pieces on the board. And bit by bit, we would place pieces on the board and move them back away from each other, and the first person to line their chess pieces up in the way you and I would start a game would be considered the winner.
There's a rather famous incident that took place at Bloomingdale's in regard to this.
Well, yes, there is. This regards Sammy Davis Jr. Marlena and I were at the counter, and Sammy Davis Jr. Came by. As a matter of fact, Sammy and Marlena had been seriously involved in an earlier period.
I didn't know this.
Yes, they had a very tumultuous, tempestuous, volatile relationship.
Was that around the time she was involved with Jerry Lewis? Or?
No. Sammy Davis was involved with Jerry Lewis. And it was Marlena who drew him away from Jerry.
Mr. Hitler was born just a cute little girl. And her parents, because he was a she. And no one really knows this, and that's why the man could not draw a straight line. It's well known that any time you delve into the sexual identity of a child, you get a slight tremor in the left hand. Now you might ask me this morning, why is he telling us Hitler is a woman? You might be asking, why did not the history books tell us that Hitler was a woman? You might be asking me, why did my father not tell me Hitler was a woman? Why was it not written in the Bible that Hitler was a woman? Why do we not see it on the newscast that Hitler was a woman? Why has our president not divulged to us that Hitler was a woman? You listen to the radio, they don't tell you Hitler was a woman. You look at the road signs, it doesn't say Hitler was a woman. And when you go to the fatherland, they don't tell you Hitler was a woman.
Costa Frangipelli from Milan, when he did the studies on the flow of life, in which he was basically laying out the concept that there was no reality that could not exist without all time stopping. And since all time could never stop, there could never be any one definition of reality, which left him with, the Two Rivers concept.
Well, you know, music exists in time. Continuous time, and that can be looked at in a philosophical and orderly sense.
But only
why
if
can't
you...
reality?
Only, well, but if I may interject, music as a form of reality can only be interpreted if one has a firm understanding of the concept of silence. Because let us forget for a moment the perception of chaotic sound, especially the chaotic sound as described by Vilos Gorman in his wonderful book Sound and Nonsense. In terms of ordered sound, musical sound, it only exists if you define silence as the absence of ordered sound. And then, in the space between music and silence, you find an area of perception which is valuable in terms of defining the concepts of the world we live in. Beauty is a chemical thing. Beauty is something which arises from within the observer, and it is something that is imposed on what is going on outside.
Is there such a thing as beauty above and beyond what each person sees as beautiful?
Yes, of course, because beauty is not only the static nature involved in harmony and balance, because of those are things that those are values that are static, but also beauty has potential. For instance, in the classic example of Helen with the face that launched a thousand ships, the potential for Helen's face, which was considered ultimately beautiful, to launch a thousand ships, created a concept in which someone else's face could launch 427 ships. And therefore, that face had potential and beauty. It can be considered in light of what it can do, how many ships a face can launch.
To understand music, you must understand silence, then is the reverse true? That if you understand silence, will you naturally understand the concept of music? Harmonious sounds emanating from somewhere. You know, because silence suggests, nothing. Silence suggests the absence of sound. And in a larger sense, you could say if there was no universe, it's the absence of presence.
Would it not be true to say that there can be no form of existence without its opposition? And that therefore the concept of music cannot exist without silence, the concept of beauty cannot exist without something that is not beautiful?
Well, if we say that, I'm not sure whether that's fair or not, but if we start with that, then the presence of nothing suggests the presence of everything.
Once again, it is too terrifying for us to contemplate the existence of something that has no finite bounds.
Why are we so terrified to imagine what you just described?
Because everything that we have ever discovered as a human race has been discovered running away from the frightening thing that has scared us terrified us into the pursuit of some sort of safety.
Well, are you saying that the search for knowledge is the search to define oneself is a search to escape from the perception of chaos?
The search for explanation is, in fact, the search for a way out of pain.
And I'm not sure if the word chaos is the right word. I think of it more in the sense of the void.
Yes, the void, the meaninglessness.
The true meaninglessness of life is a very hard thing to come to terms with.
Why?
Because if it is in fact a reality,
then why are we here?
Then why are we here?
Then what's the point of anything?
Right.
So.
But that is the concluding chapter of the Bluffhausen book, which I mentioned to you before, Philosophy as a Means of Self-Deception. We are here in order to deceive ourselves in interesting ways. That is the final chapter.
During the time when I was in Amsterdam, I was playing out my death wish. And I traveled pretty much around the world looking for death.
Why didn't you just kill yourself?
Well, I wasn't looking for my own death, you see. I was looking for death in the abstract. I was looking for his face in the mirror. I was looking for... I used to go to funerals and climb into the coffin with the dead
person. Your face
is
in the mirror. I always have
faces.
A strange sensation when I look in the mirror and see my own face when I shave. It always looks pretty unfamiliar to me, and it always changes.
You end up looking at your face probably more when you're shaving than you do when you're doing anything else.
You have a very odd face.
Every time
you end up looking
mirror,
at the face in the mirror more when you're shaving.
Well, that's a very interesting thing, because the face in the mirror is really the reverse of your face, and what you think you look like is the reverse of what you look like to everybody.
I could vibe people into dying
There's a whole question about shaving cream. Which shaving cream you want to use when... Or should you use shaving cream at all? Well, I find it's just as good with hot water rather than
have
death, all
that... In death, a clean shaven face is considerably more striking in death than a face with shaving cream all over.
They'll have shavings all over the place.
Well, but if you're clean shaven, you might as well be alive. But if you're dead, you should have a little beard. I had a little beard. You didn't wake up that morning like every other morning and shave. You're dead, and so you have a little beard.
Into drugs, too.
Have the problem of falling asleep at the time that I was falling asleep.
Double sleep.
Yes, I would try. I would want to see, experience falling asleep, and so I would go to bed and I would try to fall asleep. And then the next thing I knew, I'd be asleep.
That's
and
a very
morning.
Common
next thing
problem.
You didn't know, you'd
and
be
I could
asleep.
Never focus in on the moment because I'd fall asleep.
But you never know when you're asleep or awake when that happens. You know, you're in the middle of dreaming, and then you find out that you're really awake.
Well, I've begun to actually get a handle on that actually because
Sort of like in the Mexican desert.
And when I reached the top, there was nothing. There was complete nothingness, and I like
what
to interpret
do you mean by
my dreams.
Exactly. I mean, you know,
well, that's hard to say. You know,
it's
nada. You can't really explain.
But I mean,
it.
Is nothing the absence of something, or is nothing an actual presence that exists?
Well, you know, at some point you just
what
have
color
to,
is
have
the color
to
of
take
nothing,
the leap
you know?
Into the abyss. You know, and this happened to have been.
Well, what if you're in the abyss already? What if you're in the abyss already? How can you take a leap into the abyss if you're in the abyss? What
well,
do you do then?
This was leap year, and.
Well, I was lying in my grave, as I was saying, on the sand. They were dumping the ground on top, and I could hear it hitting the coffin.
Did you think?
And I didn't know how I was going to get myself out. And the next thing I knew, I was out of the grave, and I was walking down the street, and I never knew exactly how it was that I got out of the coffin.
Oh, well, it's easy
and
to
I still believe that somehow I'm still in that coffin.
Well, no, you see, the coffin itself could have been an entrance into another street. This is what frequently happens. The whole
or it could
idea
have been a black hole.
In the
on,
Chronicles of Nunia, the coffin is the means by which the children enter into the other world. And, you know, that's
Is time linear or circular?
It is both of those two things.
It's a wave.
It's a square through which we travel and bounce against the walls and the corner.
Time is not linear. It is definitely not linear. It may be any one of those definitions, but
time is the poetry of life. Time is what rhymes existence. It is what puts the meter and the rhythm into play. It is the serum in which the medicine that we have to swallow is dissolved.
I think time is like a hood that we have placed over our heads to allow ourselves one little crack out of which we can look, rather than merely exist in our totality.
From the minute you were conceived, time is taking you to your death, and that implication can apply to the entire universe, is that if it began somewhere, time is leading it towards its end. Oh, please excuse me. It's time for me to take this call. Sorry. I'm back.
A world in which time does not exist would create either an infinite solid or an infinite void. There would be no human part, no human aspect.
Life, must need time to be called something that exists?
No, on simplistic terms, the physical presence of something of matter, of state, of presence, would be total, infinite, solid. There would be all form of mass, all form of matter, packed into this solid. It would not be square. It would not be round.
It would be continuous. It would be a solid as vast as the universe that we can grasp, completely one amorphous mass.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Or nothing.
Mm-hmm. Or the absence of that.
Yes.
It could just be like standing at a bus stop waiting for a bus that never came.
That's right, except somehow when I picture that, I feel that I'm waiting longer and longer for that bus. Therefore, that still happens in a world where time exists.
You're saying that time creates potential, and that the waiting, which is the in essence a potential a characteristic of the action, is only apparent in a world in which time exists.
But it's very interesting, because if you've never seen a bus, and you therefore all you know is that you're waiting.
Hold on, please. I'll be right back while you think about that. Aren't there some of us who don't really want the poetry? We want to know, is there a wall there? Is there more of the same? Am I going to see, if I can travel through this endless eternity line, am I going to see my back when I get there?
What you have done is you have created exactly the conditions in which Groener has postulated his entire philosophical perspective, and that is that he
You're talking
has
about Groener the elder or Groener the son?
Groener the son. Groener the elder simply laid the groundwork for Groener the son to continue. Groener the son was a brilliant, brilliant philosopher, and he said that all you have to do is create a lifelong experiment made up of a series of experiments. If I do this, can I accomplish that? If I put myself into this situation, can I do that? And thereby avoid the concepts of pain and translate anything that appears as pain as part of the ongoing experiment. And therefore, if you can accomplish something, then you merely have an answer to a partial question. You have the answer yes or no to the first question, and it simply puts a chapter into perspective. But of course, the corollary is that you must throw that chapter away and start all over again writing chapter two. That you actually do not write a book, you write a series of nonsense tracts, which when put together are totally meaningless to anyone else but you.
Spinoza thought that a stone set in motion by an external force would believe itself to be completely free and would think that it continued in motion solely because of its own wish, provided, of course, that a stone was conscious of its own movement and was capable of thinking. Do people in the same way believe themselves to be free, but in fact, are we not free?
I feel it's quite the contrary. I feel that the stone, if it were conscious, would be thinking, why can't I stop if I want to, rather than I am moving because I choose to believe that that's what I want to do.
Would not the stone be happier if it could say, rolling as it was rolling, unable to stop, I want to move, I am moving because I want to move?
Yes, yes.
Would not it solve its immediate problem?
No, the stone might be happier. The stone might be living a more graceful life. If stones lived lives rolling through space, the stone might have less stress, if a stone could experience stress. But if the stone wasn't interested in living a graceful life or a good life or a stressless life, if the stone simply wanted to understand what is going on, and how much input do I have in what is taking place?
Yes, but the problem is that in order to do that, he has to understand what it is not to be a stone, and that enlightenment is excluded to him. I mean, it is not available to him. He cannot know what it is not to be a stone. It
even
is not available to us.
Even if he cannot know it, even if he cannot know the obverse of the reality that he is thrust into by Spinoza, all right? And I think that if stones do have a consciousness, they will never forgive Spinoza for his postulation. Because there may be stones out there rolling through space who do not understand the obverse of being a stone, who are necessarily thrust into this position through no fault of their own, except but Spinoza put them there, and they might want to know on a sort of just logical basis, based on whatever physical reality they can perceive, they might want to know what is going on and what part do they play in it. They just
yes,
might.
But all the efforts that we have put into, as human beings, into knowing what is going on, has always been, in fact, an effort to provide ourselves with limitations. And that has not given us the... I mean, I'm always amazed by the thought that to perceive and to codify limitations is to give oneself free will. And right. it would seem to me that, in fact, to give oneself to the idea of motion, regardless of where it came from, you would, in fact, find yourself in a position of true freedom, because you would then be in motion without any limitations.
Well, so in the
that's,
sense...
That's what I was suggesting
yeah,
before.
So what you're saying is that by attempting to define what your reality is, you are, the minute you do that, you are
limiting
defining
yourself.
It.
Yes, exactly. You are, in fact, placing yourself within the walls of enormous limitations by that definition.
Now, let us suggest that it was possible for all the stones that are flying about in the universe, not the stones that feel the way Tony's stone does, but the stones that are trying to find an objective reality, that are trying to get outside themselves, not accepting their own motion, their own isness, but all the other stones that do not accept, that are trying to objectify their existence. All these stones agree to write down their experiences as stones and all their experiments to find out what out-of-stone observations they might be able to make, either poetic or scientific, and write to the to a stone journal, the stone news, and have all these expressions listed and described so that all the other stones could know what each stone was thinking and the results of every stone experiment. What would you have when you compiled all these issues of the stone news? Would you have essentially a description of objective reality, what it is to be a stone? Would it be inside there? Or would that be merely garbage?
When I lived in Vienna, and Freud and I used to sit at the cafe, just whittling away some of those beautiful, beautiful evenings over there in Europe, we did what just about everybody would do. We would play chess, and that sucker just always beat me. The thing he knew how to do was work the pawns better than anybody I've ever seen in my life. And many days, Stalin walked in, because he was in town very often at that time, had various business arrangements and whatnot. And I remember one evening, just as Stalin was lifting the cup to his lips, and I'm looking at him from over the table, his eyes got big and round, and I turned back to the door, and who come walking in? But Einstein and Marilyn. Marilyn Monroe, that's right. A lot of people didn't know that they were together at that particular point in time, but they were. And the thing is, they were a lovely couple. They were very funny and very charming. And Picasso was doing portraits of the people, and you could have your portrait done in a cafe or out on the street there for, you know, $5 or $10. And he didn't make a whole lot of money, but he was having fun and getting started, I guess. That's where he really got his feet in. The woman that turned things around for me and changed my life was Eleanor Roosevelt. I met her on a beautiful day in a bocce court. She was very, very good at the game and incredibly entertaining. But before I knew it, we were taking long walks in the woods, and
taking a little punt out on the lake, and we'd always go to this little amusement park they had there with one of those very ornate Ferris wheels, which she loved so much. And now and then, we'd run into Marilyn and Albert, and it was just the sweetest little foursome and double date. And we'd always usually go do a little dance and switching partners. And Albert was such a cut up; he'd always want to do some dancing with me or something, which is just really appalled the Austrians over there. They could never understand that. And sometimes, just walking down the street looking into the pool hall, we'd see Stalin there shooting a game of eight ball. Very intense. A steady hand, but not a real good bank shot. And we'd round the corner and see Picasso sitting there doing a little painting of Hitler. It was just across the way, and kind of a rosy floral gown affair in the twilight. And so really the message here is, and what's behind all this, and how I might translate it to you, or how you could use it in your...
You do something to me.
You're sure not wasting your time?
Go on.
Something that thoroughly mesmerizes me. Tell me.
You're making me nervous.
I won't look at you.
Tell me, why should it be you have the power to mesmerize me? Let me live beneath your spell. You do that, you do that. You do so well. You do something to me that nobody...